You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, March 4th. I'm Carter from Drake University, and here's our first story. Potentially epic pollution uptick. Iowa runs risk of nitrate spikes in streams. Written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. The photo shows the North Raccoon River. A buildup of nitrate in farm fields that has likely resulted from Iowa's longest-running drought in 70 years has set the stage for a potentially massive uptick in stream pollution, state water quality observers say. Research has shown that nitrogen fertilizer that goes unused by crops can be quickly flushed from those fields after a drought year, and Iowa's drought has been ongoing for more than three. The nitrate leach is often most pronounced during significant spring rains when fields have been fertilized but crops aren't yet growing. These extreme events are quickly becoming the rule, said Chris Jones, a former University of Iowa researcher who studies agriculture's effects on water quality. If and when we return to this wet regime, it's going to be epic. An example, in 2013, record spring rainfall limited the state from one of its worst droughts. The result was more than a 400% increase in the amount of nitrate that was detected in Iowa streams from 2012 to 2013, according to data collected by the Iowa Nutrient Research Center. With stream flow data taken into account, 2013 was nearly the worst in two recent decades for nitrate pollution. The absolute amount of nitrate in streams statewide trended upward until 2016. Climate predictions show that this spring might be warmer and wetter than normal, state climatologist Justin Gleason said. That increases the likelihood of thunderstorms and their heavier rainfalls, but he said it's impossible to say whether this spring will mimic 2013. More nitrate in 2022. Nitrogen is a key nutrient for Iowa corn to ensure maximum crop yields. It is often added to fields with synthetic fertilizers and livestock manure. But it poses environmental threats beyond the fields. Rivers are a significant source of drinking water for large cities, notably those in Des Moines metro area. And nitrate must sometimes be removed from the water to make it safe to drink. Des Moines Water Works spent about $150,000 on nitrate removal in 2022. Further elevated levels of nitrate and other prominent nutrient, phosphorus, can wreak havoc on aquatic ecosystems, leading to algae blooms that diminish oxygen in the water and release toxins that are harmful to swimmers. The crop fertilizers are leading contributors to the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone. The release of nitrate into Iowa streams is expedited by the state's expansive network of underground tiling. Those perforated pipes drain soggy fields to improve crop production, but also provide a quicker pathway for nitrate into streams. About half of the state's cropland is drained by tile, according to Iowa State University, and farmers continue to install more. A recently released survey by the U.S. Department of Agriculture showed a decrease in underground tiling in recent years, but it's unclear why. In drought years, the amount of nitrate and phosphorus in streams is expected to diminish. There is less water absorbing nitrate in the soil and less surface erosion, which causes phosphorus leaching. This is reflected by the state's stream monitoring data. There were decreases in nutrient loads in 2020 and 2021 to some of their lowest levels in two decades. Parts of Iowa have been suffering from drought conditions since July 2020. About 79% of the state has some measure of drought now. But in 2022, the monitoring data for which was recently published by the state, there was an increase in stream nitrate. That's despite 2022 having slightly less average rainfall statewide than 2021. Matt Helmers, who leads the Nutrient Research Center, attributes the jump to the buildup of nitrate during the drought and rains that fell in months when crops weren't growing. Just 3 months of 2022 had above normal rainfall, according to the state weather data, March, November, and December. All of them fall outside of the state's traditional crop growing seasons. Commercial fertilizer sales also reached a new record in Iowa in 2022, according to the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and farmers have been increasingly fertilizing their fields in the fall. That creates potential for additional stream pollution because the nutrients are in the soil for longer periods of time when crops aren't growing. State ag officials have sought with greater fervor in recent years to help farmers implement edge-of-field conservation practices. The projects are meant to slow the release of surface runoff and underground water flows and to remove nutrients from them before they reach streams. The impact of that work on the state's overall water quality is not clear yet, Helmer said. The monitoring that folks are doing shows that those practices are effective, but we do need to recognize they're still treating a pretty small percentage of the landscape, he said. Stream monitoring survives budget cut. Last year, Republican lawmakers cut a third of the research center's funding and moved to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship to help pay for the projects. That annual $500,000 amount matched what the research center had devoted to operate the Iowa Water Quality Information System, which aggregates real-time nitrate contamination data. Opponents of the move feared it might have doomed the system. Without data, it'll be easy to say there's no problem or we don't know how to measure the land, Senator Janice Weiner, D. Iowa City, said last year. Instead, the research center cut its funding of the system by a third. There is still enough money to operate its network of 70 monitoring sites, said Larry Weber, director of IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa, which operates the system. The monitoring sites are especially valuable because they provide continuously updating data about nitrate concentrations, Weber said, whereas other monitoring by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources happens once each month. The DNR samples for a much wider range of contaminants. Data from both sets of monitoring sites are used by the Nutrient Research Center to calculate annual nutrient loads. While the funding cut isn't expected to disrupt the UI monitoring network itself, it will impede the analysis of the data the network produces. It's easy to collect data, Weaver said. Our staff provide an incredible support to the Nutrient Research Center at ISU, which relies on our researchers to analyze and assess. Opinions on progress differ. The state's nitrate data has shown an overall decline in stream pollution in recent years, but because of the drought, it is difficult to discern which way the situation is trending overall. Opinions about that trend vary. Helmers at the research center. It's hard to tell year to year, he said, adding that the so-called batch and build conservation program that was pioneered in the state in Polk County has led to a quicker adoption of edge of field practices. That idea, to build bioreactors and buffers along multiple farms in a small region, has been co-opted by state ag officials and is now one of the primary chosen weapons against stream contamination. We still need to scale up, Helmer said, get even more adoption of those practices. Don McDowell, communications director for the State Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Iowans recognize that our variable weather will always introduce ups and downs as we move towards achieving our long-term nutrient reduction strategy goals, he said. McDowell did not comment specifically on the department's views of the long-term trends, but said the state has broken record for conservation and water quality adoption in each of the last 2 years. The state's recent initiatives have more than doubled the dollars spent on conservation practices since the adoption in 2013 of the Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which prioritizes the voluntary efforts of farmers to curb their pollution. Its goal is to reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that leaves farm fields by 45%. McDowell noted that farmers are now planting cover crops on nearly 4 million acres of cropland, up from relatively none a decade ago. These crops are planted after harvest in fields that might otherwise be bare to control erosion and absorb nutrients that could go into streams. The acreage amounts to about 17% of the total that is planted with corn and soybeans each year. We know that these water quality practices work, and we are firmly committed toward accelerating the pace of their adoption, McDowell said. Farmers can be hesitant to change their practices because of the risks those changes pose. It may be a slower process than many would like, but from a perspective from the farmer, I'm jeopardizing my ability to stay in business if I make the bad decisions, Roger Zylstra, a Zapper Country farmer, has said. Alicia Vasto, Water Program Director for the Iowa Environmental Council. Things are not trending in the direction that everyone wants to say they are, she said. The council has criticized the state nutrient strategy and has estimated that it'll take many decades to reach its goals based on the progress has been made so far. Basto said that at a minimum, farmers should be required to create buffers between their fields and streams, and that fertilizer applications should be more restricted. Jones, the former UI researcher and author, "I think there can be no doubt that the long-term trend for nitrogen is up," he said. "At the same time that we're implementing conservation, we're also doing stuff to make it worse. That includes installing significant amounts of new drainage tile and increasing the use of fertilizers," he said. "When you look at the new nitrogen load from the new tile, that dwarfs the conservation practices," Jones said. He said the best solution to the state's water quality woes is to diversity what crops are grown, a seismic shift away from the well-entrenched focus on corn and soybeans that would require retreating from ethanol. "Ethanol has got to die," Jones said. "It just has to if we're going to improve the environmental condition in Iowa." That is unlikely, at least in the foreseeable future. More than half the state's corn is used to produce ethanol, and state leaders have pushed to expand its use. Further, carbon dioxide pipelines are potentially poised to increase the fuel's longevity, despite federal goals to shift to electric cars. A state report on the status of Iowa's waterways is due to the Environmental Protection Agency soon. That update will list the streams, lakes, and wetlands the Iowa Department of Natural Resources deems impaired. The impairments can include contamination by nitrate and other pollutants, elevated bacteria counts, and lackluster fish populations and diversity, among others. In its 2022 assessment, the DNR noted more than 750 impaired waters. The next story is titled "Proposal Would Expand Highway 30," written by Tom Barton of the Gazette. The image shows Highway 30 through Denison, pictured in 2017, with cars and a red tree. Iowa State Transportation Commission would be required to prioritize making all of U.S. Highway 30 four lanes under a bill passed by the Iowa House on Thursday. Lawmakers passed House File 2569 by a vote of 87-4. The bill would require the Iowa Transportation Commission to include in its long-range planning plans to make the entire length of Highway 30 four lanes, including a 40-mile stretch between DeWitt and Lisbon, just east of Cedar Rapids, and between Carroll and Ogden in western Iowa. Economic developers, business leaders, and government officials in Clinton County have advocated for the better part of two decades for the state to modify and expand Highway 30 between DeWitt and Lisbon to four lanes. Representatives with the U.S. Highway 30 Coalition have told lawmakers such a project would spur rural business development, foster population growth, improve roadway safety, lessen congestion on Interstate 80, and match the majority of Highway 30's cross-state footprint. Instead of a four-lane layout, the Iowa Department of Transportation's five-year highway plan calls for changing the current two-lane layout of Highway 30 from Lisbon to Stanwood to a Super 2 configuration that would enable the construction of wider lanes, a hard shoulder, and occasional turning and passing lanes. Work is scheduled to begin for the fiscal year that starts July 1st and ends June 30th, 2025, with pavement improvement from east of Lisbon to west of Mechanicsville. Property acquisition for the section of highway west of Mechanicsville to west of Stanwood is scheduled to begin in the fiscal year 2025, with construction in the next year. Meanwhile, work is ongoing to finish four-lane construction in Benton County, which is slated to be completed this year, according to the DOT. Stuart Anderson, Director of Transportation Development for Iowa DOT, says the department decided against a four-lane layout in favor of the Super 2 alternative due to cost savings. He said the DOT estimated it would cost 15% to 20% of the cost of upgrading to a four-lane highway and wouldn't require nearly as much property acquisition. The bill was amended to state the Iowa DOT would not use eminent domain to acquire land necessary to expand two-lane sections of Highway 30 to four lanes until it has expanded all reasonable alternatives if the land is a part of Century Farm or residential real estate property. A study conducted by Iowa engineering firm Snyder & Associates and paid for by the Highway 30 Coalition estimated it would cost more than $636 million to expand a 45-mile stretch of the highway to four lanes between Carroll and Ogden, and a 44-mile stretch from Lisbom to DeWitt over a 10-year period, and the estimated financial benefit to the state would be more than $770 million. Roughly 160 miles of the 331-mile-long highway in Iowa is four lanes. The study did not include the cost to expand the stretch of highway west of Carroll. U.S. Route 30, often called the Lincoln Highway, spans coast to coast from New York City to San Francisco. A fiscal analysis of the bill by the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimates the full expansion of Highway 30 would cost $1.5 billion throughout the course of the construction. Federal funding could cover up 80% of the total cost, but will depend on future state budgeting decisions. LSA estimates two lanes will be need to be added to about 120 miles at an estimated cost of $6.7 million per lane. Four-lane bypasses would need to be constructed for about 39.5 miles, costing an estimated $10 million per mile, along with 16 interchanges costing about $16.1 million each. Annual maintenance costs for the full 120 miles is estimated to be approximately $1.7 million per year. There is over 500,000 people living along the highway corridor, and it's actually the only corridor outside of Interstate 80 that is growing, said Representative Tom Detterman, R. Kimmich, the bill's lead sponsor. Highway 30 has been recommended as a four-lane corridor, 160 miles off of its four lanes, and so we need to finish it. Detterman said a four-lane highway divided highway is 60% safer than a two-lane highway. Communities in northern Iowa lobbied for years to make U.S. Highway 20 a four-lane expressway from Sioux City to Dubuque. The first four-lane stretch of Highway 20 was completed in 1958 and the last in 2018, 60 years later. Detterman said the state has seen economic growth along Highway 20 and is looking to see the same development along Highway 30. It's a win for rural Iowa, he told the Gazette, noting highway spans 12 counties and 39 cities. Rep. Adam Zabner, D. Iowa City, has voted against the measure, said while he would like to see the highway expanded, he's concerned about the potential politicization of what should be routine infrastructure spending. The bill now heads to the Iowa Senate, where Detterman said a subcommittee is scheduled to consider the bill next week. Senator Chris Kearney, R. LeClaire, introduced companion legislation in the Senate last year, but it failed to advance out of the chamber. Kerner's district includes Clinton County. Detterman said he hopes to push the bill through the Senate before March 15th legislative deadline. The next story is titled, Leaders Present Six Bills. New legislation sets full-year spending levels for some agencies, written by Kevin Frecking of the Associated Press. Federal government, Washington. Congressional leaders on Sunday came out with a package of six bills setting full-year spending levels for some federal agencies, a step forward in a long overdue funding process beset by sharp political divisions between the two parties, as well as infighting among House Republicans. The release of the text of legislation over the weekend was designed to meet the House's rule to give lawmakers at least 72 hours to study a bill before voting. And it's a promising sign that lawmakers will avoid a partial shutdown that would kick in at 12:01 a.m. Saturday for those agencies covered under the bill, such as Veterans Affairs, Agriculture, Transportation, Justice, and others. Congressional leaders hope to complete votes on the package this week and continue negotiations on the remaining six annual spending bills to pass them before March 22nd deadline. The price tag for the package out Sunday comes to about $460 billion, representing less than 30% of the discretionary spending Congress looks to approve for this year. The package still being negotiated includes defense spending. House Speaker Mike Johnson highlighted some key policy and spending wins for conservatives, even as many of his GOP colleagues consider the changes inadequate. Some House Republicans had hoped the prospect of a shutdown could leverage more concessions from Democrats. Overall, this year's spending bills would keep non-defense spending relatively flat with last year's bill, despite the rise in inflation and some $70 billion less than what President Joe Biden originally sought. House Republicans secured key conservative policy victories, rejected left-wing proposals, and imposed sharp cuts to agencies and programs critical to President Biden's agenda, Johnson said in a prepared statement. Earlier this year, Johnson and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced an agreement on top-line spending levels for this year's discretionary spending, which comes to more than $1.6 trillion. But that agreement didn't address potential policy mandates placed within the bill. That's where negotiations have focused in recent weeks. Democrats starved off most of the policy riders that House Republicans sought to include. For example, they beat back an effort to reverse the FDA's decision that allows the abortion pill Mifepristone to be sold in retail pharmacies instead of only in hospitals, clinics, and medical offices. Democrats also said the bill would fully fund a nutrition program for low-income women, infants, and children known as WIC, providing about $7 billion for the program, a $1 billion increase from the previous year. House Republicans were able to achieve some policy wins, however. One provision, for example, will prevent the sale of oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to China. The next story is titled, Thousands Remember Bloody Sunday. Harris Honors Activists Warns of Modern-Day Attacks on Freedom, written by Kim Chandler of the Associated Press. Alabama Voting Rights March, Selma, Alabama. Vice President Kamala Harris told thousands gathered for the 59th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday attacks on civil rights marches in Selma, Alabama, that fundamental freedoms, including the right to vote, are under attack in America even today. Harris joined those gathered at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where voting rights activists were beaten back by law enforcement officers in 1965. The vice president praised the marchers' bravery for engaging in a defining moment of the civil rights struggle. Today, we know our fight for freedom is not over, because in this moment we are witnessing a full-on attack on hard-fought, hard-won freedoms, starting with the freedom that unlocks all others, the freedom to vote, Harris said. She criticized attempts to restrict voting, including limits on absentee voting and early voting, and said the nation is again at a crossroads. What kind of country do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a country of freedom, liberty, and justice, or a country of injustice, hate, and fear? Harris asked, encouraging people to answer with their vote. She paid tribute to civil rights marchers who walked across the bridge in 1965, knowing they would face certain violence in seeking a future that was more equal, more just, and more free. Decisions by the Supreme Court and lower courts in 2006 have weakened the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was passed in the wake of police attacks in Selma. The demonstrators were beaten by officers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7, 1965, as they tried to march across Alabama to support voting rights. Harris drew parallels between those who worked to stifle the civil rights movement and extremists, she said, are trying to enact restrictions on voting, education, and reproductive care. She said other fundamental freedoms under attack include the freedom of a woman to make decisions about her own body, a reference to state abortion bans. She also stressed the Biden administration's support for a six-week ceasefire in Gaza to get the hostages out and a significant amount of aid. Under a blazing blue sky, Harris then led the crowd across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the march that concludes the annual commemoration. Thousands followed, sometimes singing hymns and anthems of the civil rights movement, including, "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around." Earlier Sunday, Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke at a Selma church service marking the anniversary of the attack by Alabama law officers on civil rights demonstrators. He said recent court decisions and certain state legislation have endangered voting rights in much of the nation. Since those court decisions, there's been a dramatic increase in legislative measures that make it harder for millions of eligible voters to vote and to elect representatives of their choice, Garland told worshippers at Selmer's Tabernacle Baptist Church, the site of one of the first mass meetings of the voting rights movement. The next story is titled, Israeli Prime Minister Angered by Rivals' U.S. Visit. Centrist Gantz's trip signals cracks in country's leadership, written by Tia Goldenberg, Wafa Shufara, and Sami Magdi of the Associated Press. Tel Aviv, Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rebuked a top cabinet minister arriving in Washington on Sunday for talks with U.S. officials, according to an Israeli official, signaling widening cracks within the country's leadership nearly 5 months into its war with Hamas. The trip by Benny Gantz, a centrist political rival who joined Netanyahu's wartime cabinet following Hamas's October 7th attack, comes as friction between the U.S. and Netanyahu is rising over how to alleviate the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza and what the post-war plan for the enclave should look like. An official from Netanyahu's far-right Likud party said Gantz's trip was planned without authorization from the Israeli leader. The official said Netanyahu had a tough talk with Gantz and told him the country has just one prime minister. Gantz is scheduled to meet Monday with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and on Tuesday with Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, according to his National Unit Party. A second Israeli official speaking on condition of anonymity said Gantz's visit is intended to strengthen ties with the U.S. and bolster support for Israel's war. In Egypt, talks were underway to broker a ceasefire between the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins next week. Israel did not send a delegation because the government is reportedly waiting to learn which hostages are alive and how many Palestinian prisoners Hamas seeks in exchange for each. The next story is titled, California Girds for More Heavy Snow, written by The Digest. Truckee, California. A major highway was closed as ski resorts were shut down Sunday as the effects of a powerful blizzard continue to cause problems across the Sierra Nevada, and forecasters warned that more heavy snow is on the way for Northern California. Sections of Interstate 80 to the west and north of Lake Tahoe were made impassable by blowing snow piling up in lanes, with no estimate for reopening, the California Highway Patrol said. A CHP office in South Lake Tahoe warned motorists that tire chains for improvised traction are required on routes through the mountains, where more than 7 feet of snow fell over the weekend. The online warning Sunday was accompanied by a photo of a big rig without chains stuck in whiteout conditions on a local road. Trying to bypass chain control, no, the agency said on X, formerly Twitter, dangerous and not smart. The next story is titled, Zelensky Urges Allies to Boost Military Aid. Kyiv, Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky urged Western allies to boost Ukraine's air defenses after a Russian drone strike destroyed an apartment block in the southern port city of Odessa and killed at least 11 people. Officials on Sunday said the bodies of a boy and a young woman clutching an infant were pulled from Saturday's rubble. The mother tried to cover the 8-month-old child with her own body. She tried to save them. They were found in a firm embrace, said a Telegram post published on the Interior Ministry's official channel. On Saturday, Ukrainian authorities said another baby was among those killed after falling debris from an Iranian-made drone hit the building. Later that day, Zelensky said a second child, aged 2, has also died. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, March 4th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Carter from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this, or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Here are the obituaries from Saturday, March 2nd. Melvin Meritz. Melvin Leroy Meritz, age 85 of Council Bluffs, died at home on February 21st, 2024, with his wife and family. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1938 to parents Betty and Leslie Meritz. He was the oldest of 11 kids. Melvin attended and graduated from Omaha Technical High School. Always smiling, laughing, loving, and a very caring man. He loved life and making people happy, especially while dancing with the ladies. He was adored by Eileen and all of the family and countless friends. He was a champion golfer and number one tennis player at Riverview in Arizona. He played daily until the age of 80. He was a man of many hats. He was most proud of being a police officer and detective, and his children. Mel was preceded in death by his mom and dad, sisters Sandy, Nancy, daughter Julie, and previous wives Sonny and Ruth. He is survived by his loving wife, Eileen, whom he cherished and loved, siblings Karen, Luke, Leslie, Margaret, Jim, Donna, Pamela, Darlene, Jr., Mike, Robin, Gary, Scott, children Jay, Sue, Cindy, John, Marcy, Dan, 8 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, Eileen's children Brenda, David, Peggy, Greg, Michael, Kelly, 4 grandchildren, and hundreds of nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews. He loved every one of you dearly. A celebration will be held at a later date. Gordon Smith. August 31, 1932, February 21, 2024. Gordon D. Smith, age 91, passed away on February 21, 2024. He was born August 31, 1932, to the late Dale and Ethel Smith in Council Bluffs. Gordon graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School with the class of 1950, and then proudly served his country in the United States Air Force during the Korean War. He retired from Mutual of Omaha. Gordon was a lifetime member of the Council Bluffs Rifle and Pistol Club and the Great Plains Wing of Commemorative Air Force Museum. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his son, Stephen Smith, sisters Cheryl Feakin and Joanne Cochran. Gordon is survived by his wife of 70 years, Etta Mae Smith, children Kimberly Setzerkorn, Jeffrey Smith, Lynn McCourt, and Sherry Stivers, 12 grandchildren, and 16 great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Friday, March 8, 2024. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Friday, March 8, 2024. The family will direct memorials. Peter Laustrup. Peter C. Laustrup, age 70, passed away at his home on February 24, 2024. He was born August 28, 1953, to the late Donald and Angela Laustrup in Omaha, Nebraska. Peter graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School with the class of 1972 and then proudly served his country in the United States Navy. He retired International Game Co. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his wife, Mary Laustrup, infant brother, Geoffrey Laustrup. Peter is survived by his son, Brian Laustrup, siblings Mark Laustrup, Mike Laustrup, Kirsten Halberg, Dana Engel, Chris Laustrup, grandsons Hayden Phippen, Dominic Laustrup, and Benson Laustrup, nieces, nephews, and cousins, a host of other family and friends. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Monday, March 4, 2024. The family will receive friends during the hour prior to the service. Memorials are suggested to ALS in the heartland of Folds of Honor. Next, we'll move into sports. The title of this story is Clark Stands Alone. Iowa star breaks Maravich's NCAA D1 scoring record, written by Eric Olson of the Associated Press. College basketball. Caitlin Clark stood alone at the free throw line on Sunday and made the foul shots that left her standing alone atop the all-time NCAA Division I scoring chart. The flash and pizzazz of her game have made her the biggest name in all of college basketball. Yet it was the two free throws after a technical foul that pushed Clark past the late Pete Maravich's 54-year-old record in number 6 Iowa's 93-83 win over number 2 Ohio State. Clark entered the game in Iowa City needing 18 points to pass Maravich's total of 3,667, amassed in just 83 games over three seasons at LSU from 1967 to 1970. She finished with 35 to run her total to 3,685 in 130 games. Maravich's mark fell 4 days after Clark broke Lynette Woodard's major college basketball record with 33 points against Minnesota on Wednesday. Best known for her long three-pointers, Clark was called on to go to the foul line after Cody McMahon was assessed with a technical for giving her a little push during a dead ball with less than a second to go in the first half. Clark had no immediate reaction after the second shot went through, as if it hadn't sunk in yet. Asked in a television interview at halftime if she was aware of the record when she stepped to the line, Clark said, "Not really. When they announced it and everybody screamed, that's when I knew." The celebration was on, with Clark jumping around and pumping her fists in the air. She had gotten off to a slow start Sunday. Her first shot was a three-pointer that bounced off the rim. She missed a layup and from deep on the right wing before making a three from the left side for her first basket. After starting 2-for-7, she made 3 of her next 4 shots, including 3 straight threes, each deeper than the previous. Woodard was among the attendees at Carver Hawkeye Arena to help Clark celebrate Senior Day. Also on hand were basketball great Maya Moore, who was Clark's favorite player, and Baseball Hall of Fame pitcher Nolan Ryan. "It's a great time for women's basketball," Woodard said in a television interview. "Caitlin is leading the way. As she was chipping away, I said records are made to be broken. Also, they're made to be honored. Because of her, my records are being honored. She's gone beyond that now. She's gone beyond Pete. I passed her the baton to go ahead and burst through that ceiling, and I'm so happy for her." On Thursday, Clark announced that she would enter the 2024 WNBA draft and skip the fifth year of eligibility available to athletes who competed during the COVID-19 pandemic. She is projected to be the number 1 overall pick by the Indiana Fever, and the WNBA is already seeing a rise in its ticket sales. Logitix, who researches prices on ticket resale platforms, reported an average sale price of $598 for a ticket to Sunday's game purchased since February 1st. Kieran Nanjapa, who was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and now lives in Denver, said he paid more than $200 for his ticket. "She's truly a once-in-a-lifetime player," he said. "I've been watching Iowa basketball for 40 years, and I've never seen a player like her, men's or women's. I'll just say this, I paid more to see her today than I paid to see Michael Jordan 3 times at the end of his career, and I never thought I'd say that." Clark is all but assured of 1 or 2 more appearances at the arena in Iowa City. Iowa is projected to be a number 2 seed for the NCAA tournament, meaning it would be at home for the first 2 rounds. Pearl Moore of Francis Marion owns the overall women's record with 4,061 points from 1975 to 79 at the small college level in the IAAW. Moore had 177 points at Anderson Junior College before enrolling at Francis Marion. Clark is 376 points behind Moore, and she has only 2 to 9 more games left in an Iowa uniform, depending on how far the Hawkeyes advance in the Big Ten and NCAA tournaments. The fall of Maravich's record is subject to scrutiny. Maravich's all-time scoring mark is one of the more remarkable in sports history. There was no shot clock or three-point line in his era. The three-point line was adopted in 1986. Maravich averaged 44.2 points per game. He scored more than 60 in a game 4 times, topping out at 69 against Alabama on February 7, 1970. Clark averages 28.3 points for her career. Her career best output was 49 points against Michigan on February 15th when she passed Kelsey Plum as the NCAA Women's Division I career scoring leader. Clark has 55 games with at least 30 points, the most of any player in men's or women's college basketball over the last 25 years. She has 6 triple-doubles this season and 17 in her career. What Caitlin's done has been amazing. She's a fantastic player great for the women's game and basketball in general, Maravich's eldest son, Jason, told the Associated Press last week. The next story is titled, Larson Wins Again at Las Vegas. Hendrick Motorsports wins second race, Chevrolet undefeated, written by Jenna Fryer, Associated Press. The image shows NASCAR Cup Series driver Kyle Larson celebrating after winning the Pennzoil 400 on Sunday at Las Vegas Motor Speedway. Las Vegas. There's a tradition at Hendrick Motorsports to ring the winning bell throughout the North Carolina shop after every NASCAR victory. As motivation to have the best year of his career, Kyle Larson's team decided to bring a bell on the road so avoid having to wait to return to Charlotte to celebrate every achievement he plans for the season. The bell got its first ring Sunday when Larson won his second consecutive race at Las Vegas Motor Speedway to keep Chevrolet undefeated and give Rick Hendrick his second victory in the first three NASCAR Cup Series races of the season. Hendrick Motorsports is celebrating its 40th anniversary this season and opened the year with William Byron winning the Daytona 500. That bell will travel with us every week and we'll be ringing it loud and proud, Larson said. Larson won for the third time in his career at Las Vegas, where in 2021 he got his first win driving for Hendrick following a nearly year-long suspension in 2020. Larson also won in the number 5 Chevy at Las Vegas last October in the playoffs. Larson held off Tyler Reddick for his 24th career Cup victory. In a Toyota for 23XI Racing, Reddick chased Larson for the final several laps, but could never find enough room to make a move for the pass. Larson's margin of victory was 0.441 seconds over Reddick. I knew Tyler was going to be the guy to beat from the first stage. He was really fast there, Larson said. Cool to get a win here at Vegas again. Back to back, swept all the stages again. Can't ask for more than that. Reddick was extremely frustrated after finishing second and believed Larson as the leader controlled the race because of the rules of NASCAR's new car. Kyle did a really good job there, taking away pretty much every option I had to close the gap, Reddick said. Second sucks, that is for sure. You have to run up front all day long, and when asked about what we need to do to get better, that's the very thing, and we didn't do it. We were pretty evenly matched, so I don't know if there's anything I really could have done to get around him. He would have had to make a big mistake or some traffic kind of knock his win around. It's a solid effort for our team. That's how we need to run. But I don't like running second. The next story is titled, UConn Earns Big East Regular Season Championship. Huskies win their first outright conference title in 25 years, written by Pat Eaton Robb of the Associated Press. Stores, Connecticut. Number 3 UConn is a defending men's national champion. However, the Huskies had not even won a share of the Big East regular season title in 18 years. Donovan Klingon scored 19 points and pulled down 11 rebounds to lead a balanced attack, and Connecticut clinched its first outright Big East championship in 25 years Sunday with a 91-61 rout of Seton Hall. The team considered the achievement big enough to cut down the nets at Gamble Pavilion after the game. The hardest thing to do is to be excellent over the course of 3-4 months in a brutal, hard league, Coach Dan Hurley said. Freshman Stephon Castle tied a career high with 21 points, and Tristan Newton had 17 points and 10 assists for the Huskies, who finished the season undefeated at home. Alex Caraban added 13 points. Dre Davis had 20 points, and Kadari Richmond scored 15 to lead Seton Hall, which remains in fourth place in the Big East with a loss, a game ahead of Villanova. UConn, which lost at Seton Hall by 15 points in December, shot 56% from the floor, outscored the Pirates 52-30 in the paint, out-rebounded them 38-26, and scored 24 points off 11 Seton Hall turnovers. I feel like our defense really went to the next level, said Klingon, who missed 5 games after suffering a right foot injury during the loss in New Jersey. Coach has really emphasized just trying to work on our defense, just trying to really guard the ball at a high level, rebound the ball at a high level. The next story is titled, Chris Mortensen, award-winning NFL reporter, dies at 72, written by Joe Reedy of the Associated Press. Chris Mortensen, the award-winning journalist who covered the NFL for close to 4 decades, including 32 as a senior analyst at ESPN, died Sunday morning. He was 72. ESPN confirmed Mortensen's death on Sunday. There was no immediate word on the cause or place of death. Mort was widely respected as an industry pioneer and universally beloved as a supportive, hardworking teammate, ESPN president Jimmy Pitaro said in a statement. He covered the NFL with extraordinary skill and passion and was at the top of his field for decades. He will truly be missed by colleagues and fans, and our hearts and thoughts are with his loved ones. Mortensen announced in 2016 he had been diagnosed with throat cancer. Even while undergoing treatment, he was the first to confirm the retirement of Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning. "We lost a true legend," Manning said in a social media post. "Mort was the best in the business, and I cherished our friendship. I trusted him with my announcement to sign with the Broncos and with the news of my retirement. I will miss him dearly, and my thoughts and prayers are with Mickey and his family. Rest in peace, Mort." Mortensen announced his retirement after the NFL draft last year so that he could focus on my health, family, and faith. He is survived by his wife, Mickey, and son, Alex. The next story is titled, "Celtics Win by Third Largest Margin in Franchise History," written by the Associated Press. The image shows Celtics guard Jaylen Brown celebrating near Warriors forward Trayce Jackson-Davis. Boston. Jaylen Brown scored 29 points, Jason Tatum had 27 on his 26th birthday, and the Boston Celtics posted their third largest winning margin in franchise history, drubbing the Golden State Warriors 140-88 on Sunday. Peyton Pritchard added 19 points for the NBA-leading Celtics, who set a record with their third win this season by 50 points or more, and extended their season-best winning streak to 11 games. Boston led by a franchise record 44 points at halftime and pushed it to 51 early in the third quarter before coach Joe Mazzulla went to his reserves. Stephen Curry didn't play in the second half and finished with a season-low 4 points for Golden State, his fewest since he had 3 points in 16 minutes on March 6, 2022 at Boston, a game he departed with a foot injury. Curry was 2 of 13 from the field Sunday and missed all 9 of his 3-point attempts, including consecutive air balls in the opening quarter. Lester Quinones led Golden State with 17 points. Clippers 89, Timberwolves 88. Kawhi Leonard had 32 points, and Los Angeles beat host Minnesota in a physical and defensive game between two of the top 4 teams in the Western Conference. 76ers 120, Mavericks 116. Tobias Harris scored 28 points, and Philadelphia won at Dallas. Luka Doncic had 38 points, 11 rebounds, and 10 assists for his third straight triple-double, but he also added 17 turnovers for the sloppy Mavericks. Raptors 111, Hornets 106. Emmanuel Quickley scored 22 points and matched his season high with 11 assists. RJ Barrett had 23 points, and Toronto beat Charlotte at home for the 7th straight time. Spurs 117, Pacers 105. Victor Wembanyama had 31 points and 12 rebounds to lead San Antonio past visiting Indiana. He added 6 blocks, 6 assists, and a steal while going 3-for-4 on 3-pointers. Knicks 107, Cavaliers 98. Dante DiVincenzo scored 28 points, Josh Hart had 19 rebounds, 13 points, and 10 assists, and New York earned a gritty win at Cleveland despite an injury to Jalen Brunson. Thunder 118, Suns 110. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander 36 points, 10 rebounds, and 9 assists, and Oklahoma City held off host Phoenix after leading by 24 points during the third quarter. Magic 113, Pistons 91. Paolo Banchero scored 29 points for a second straight game, and Orlando completed a 4-game season sweep of visiting Detroit. Brunson bruises left knee, exits early, by the Associated Press. Cleveland. Knicks All-Star guard Jalen Brunson had to be helped off the floor Sunday with a left knee bruise in the first minute against the Cavaliers. Brunson, who averages 27.2 points per game, was hurt while attempting a jump shot over Cleveland's Isaac Okoro. Brunson came off a screen near the foul line and raised up without any contact. Following the game, Knicks coach Tom Thibodeau said x-rays on Brunson's knee were negative, a report that brought relief to New York fans. "It's a knee contusion," said a relaxed Thibodeau. "He bumped knees, that's what happened. He got the x-rays, was examined by the doctor. Everything was negative, we'll see where he is tomorrow." On the play, the 27-year-old Brunson shot an air ball, and his legs split awkwardly as he came back down. He staggered to the three-point line before falling to the floor while grabbing his left leg in obvious pain. Brunson sat on the floor as play continued and briefly got up before limping to the sideline and dropping back down. A replay showed that early in New York's first possession, Brunson banged knees with Knicks center Isaiah Hartenstein as he moved past his teammate, setting a screen for him. Brunson did not return to the bench and was not seen after the game. Brunson has been keeping the Knicks together during a rough stretch of injuries. They've been without Julius Randle, Mitchell Robinson, and OG Anunoby, who all made the trip and are getting close to returning. Next, we'll move into the lifestyle section. The story is titled The Year of the Anhelonia, on Gardening, written by Norman Winter of the Tribune News Service. The image shows the Anhelonia flower. The National Garden Bureau has designated 2024 as the Year of the Anhelonia, and I am in full celebration mode. As I was preparing for my contribution to the celebration, I was, however, sent into taxonomic trauma. For the past 26 years of deep love of the Anhelonia, or summer snapdragon, I have told everyone via newspaper, radio, and TV that they were in the Scrophulariaceae family. Since most gardeners don't like those words, I modified or simplified the snapdragon family. Somebody, however, has tinkered with the green industry happiness and moved the Anhelonia to the Plantaginaceae or plantain family. I immediately reached out to my friend Alan Onings, horticulture professor emeritus with the LSU Ag Center. I said, "Did you know this, or better yet, did you do it?" He said, "As I expected, the taxonomous group had done it." This reminded me that someone once said taxonomists have to eat too. I know what you are thinking. Does this mean that the Anhelonia, or summer snapdragon, is now related to the Hosta or plantain lily? The answer is no, as the Hosta or plantain lily is in the Asparagaceae or asparagus family. You see where I'm going with this. So then you are suspecting the Anhelonia or summer snapdragon, which is in the plantain family, must be related to the plantain bananas. That would also be a no, as bananas are in the Muscaceae or banana family. At this point, I would warn bananas to not get too comfortable. Supposedly DNA fingerprinting led to this family annulment, and since there were a lot more that fell prey, Penstemon, Linaria, Digitalis, Snapdragon, Veronica, and no doubt more that mere mortals wouldn't understand. I have to add, though, somehow Nemesia and Diasia stayed in the Scrophulariaceae, or figwort family. But back to our celebration of the year of the Anhelonia, or summer snapdragon. 26 years ago, was the first time I wrote about the Anhelonia. Never did a new plant cause such excitement. This gave the South a summer plant that bloomed all summer and looked like a snapdragon or foxglove. It was so good that the University of Florida recognized Hilo Princess as the plant of the year. Now every company has their own series. Proven Winners has the Angel Face series with three distinct types: Standard, Super, and Cascade. They are tough as nails and will bloom all summer. The Standard reaches 18 to 30 inches tall with an 18-inch spread. The Super is indeed that, with the ability to reach 30 to 40 inches tall and a spread up to 16 inches. The Cascade group can reach 8 to 14 inches in height with a spread of up to 30 inches. The Angel Face series has won almost 100 awards and offers gardeners the best for their landscape or mixed containers where they can be used as the thriller, spiller, or filler. The Cascade group provides hanging basket design options that will take your visitor's breath away. Angel Face Anhelonias, by virtue of their Mexico and West Indies native habitat, are rock solid in our U.S. summers. They are drought tolerant, but remember that they do come from an area of high rainfall. They simply ask not to be grown in a moisture-laden bog or to dry out to a wilting point. Feed every 2 weeks with a water-soluble mixed fertilizer. They require no pruning or deadheading as you transition through the gardening season. If top performer and perfect scores awards are what you are looking for, then put Angel Face at the top of your list for the summer. You too can celebrate the year of the Anhelonia. Follow Norman Winter on Facebook at Norman Winter, the Garden Guy. And that brings us to the end of today's readings of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, March 4th. The Nonpareil can be heard here each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Carter from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. We call Earth the blue planet because it's covered in water. But what makes water blue? And why is it not blue in your glass or your ice cubes? Water has many rare properties, some of which we've covered on previous episodes. But this property, its blueness, is unique to water and goes right to its core. It's the only molecule in the universe that vibrates a color. How is that? The water molecule is made up of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. The hydrogen atoms are very lightweight, but their bonds are very strong. Imagine ping pong balls connected by metal springs. It doesn't take much to start water molecules vibrating. In basic terms, light itself is vibrating electromagnetic energy. Different colors have different vibrational frequencies. Water molecules vibrate fast enough to reach the lower frequencies of visible light. Well, they absorb red light, so we see the blue light that remains. This effect is too faint to notice in your glass of water. But it's already visible in a bathtub or swimming pool, and gets more pronounced when the effect is amplified, as light passes through more and deeper water. Scuba divers know this well. Past a certain depth, blue becomes the only color, till they turn on a flashlight, which reintroduces full-spectrum white light, and all the colors appear again. There are other molecules that vibrate, but none that can reach into the visible light spectrum. Only water is true blue. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.